because you're married now, you're say women take care of
that way.
It was a while ago.
And also, they may have other issues.
Racial meeting.
I'm going to call the House Judiciary Committee to order.
Calling the Senate Judiciary Interim Committee to order this time. We're going to have some bill introductions. I think the House is going to start first.
We will. The bills that we're going to be introducing as committee bills and come in, as a courtesy, we've always moved those into the process. That does not mean that the bill would even get a hearing or be passed, and you're not required or expected to vote for it. After you hear the bill, then you can make up your mind. So this is just to get it into the process.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 44, dated December 14th, 2011. LC 54, dated November 30th, 2011. LC 55, dated December 5th, 2011. LC 101, dated January 9th, 2012. And LC 136, dated January 11th, 2012.
Richard Barker moves that the previously listed LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? No objections? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills.
Okay. All right, and at this time, the chair of the Senate committee will entertain a motion regarding the LC drafts that we have for the Senate Interim Committee.
Chair Przanski, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 46, dated January 4th, 2012. LC 49, dated January 6th, 2012. LC 50, dated January 5th, 2012. LC 51, dated December 7th, 2011. LC 100, dated January 17th, 2012.
Senator Wissett moves that the previous listed LCs be introduced as committee bills. Before we take any discussion, I do want to put on the record that this is a courtesy that we have done traditionally to allow for bills that come in as committee bills to be introduced through this process. This does not mean, with an affirmative vote, that the members that are supporting the introduction of these bills will be supporting those bills in any shape, fashion, or form during the process during the short session in February of 2012. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Did Jim want to go ahead and start?
Call up the first panel?
The first item on the agenda today is an informal meeting, a report on the Commission on Public Safety. Chief Justice Paul DeMunis, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Paul DeMunez. I'm Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I had the privilege of serving by the appointment of Governor Kitzhaber as chair of the Commission on Public Safety. We filed our report with the governor on December 30th. That report has been circulated electronically to all the members of the legislature. I just want to very briefly review the executive order, which created the commission, was dated July 15, 2011. In that order, the governor asked us to develop concepts on comprehensive public safety policy, focusing on four outcomes. One, the safety of our citizens in their homes and communities, accountability for criminal offenses, an efficient system that controls costs, and a system that is smart and fair. The members of the commission included three of your colleagues who are here this afternoon, Senator Przanski, Representative Garrett, Representative Olson, also on the committee were Senator Winters and former Governor Kulongowski, and our public member was Dick Withnell. I want to say publicly what a privilege it was to serve with the members of the committee. It was a great honor for me, and I learned a lot from your legislative colleagues in the process. Very briefly, we held four meetings, one in Portland, two in Salem, and one in Medford. We entertained evidence from experts throughout the country. We compiled those findings and recommendations in our report. They're very detailed. I wanted to just briefly, sort of in my own words, briefly run through those findings, and then I'd answer any questions that the committee may have. Basically, these findings would go in this category. In terms of long-term planning, we need to look at reforming our sentencing system to slow prison growth, which would allow us to avoid the predicted 2,000 more inmates in our institution. We need to use savings from trimming the prison population to combat recidivism and spend more money on the reentry of our prisoners into our communities. 93% of all inmates return to our communities. We need to bolster programs to help crime victims, particularly those of domestic and sexual assaults. We need to use more cost-benefit analysis to sharply direct our spending. We need to better assess risks and needs of offenders at sentencing, shaping punishment to individuals, and give judges more discretion at sentencing. We need to give Oregonians more information about crime. One of the major findings for us was there's a disconnect between the crime rates and the public's perception of crime in this state, and I think that's borne out nationally, actually. We recommended that we extend the commission's work through July 2013, that we add members to the commission representing sheriffs, police chiefs, district attorneys, judges, and addiction and mental health experts. I've not met with the governor to review those findings or recommendations with him, and as I said, I've circulated the report electronically to all members of the legislature.
Any questions, Chief Justice? Senator Whitsitt, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Mr. Chief, when I was reading through this report, I really didn't see where the commission focused on trying to reduce the costs of the incarceration and the Department of Corrections Services. I believe that stands at about $94 a day now for per inmate in the Department of Corrections, and somewhere in the ballpark of $325 in the Oregon Youth Authority. I don't know the figures in Idaho for the Youth Authority, but the figures in Idaho for incarceration in Idaho per inmate is about $62. So if you take a $30 times 14,000, which is $420,000 a day, times 365 times 2 years, you're somewhere in the ballpark of $360 million that we could save without turning anybody loose, without turning any violent felons loose, if we just reduce the cost down to what Idaho currently spends. So was that discussed?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, thank you for your question. As you know, we had literally about 4.5 months to do our work. That was not a big part of our work, but we did take some testimony and had some information about that. You're correct. There is a difference between our spending and a number of other states. However, what I got from that testimony and that evidence was that difference is accounted for, that in most of those states, they're right-to-work states. And so it made a big difference in their labor costs.
Just to be clear, then the roughly $360 million difference is in increased personal services costs.
I think that a great deal of that would be so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Move on to the next item on the agenda. Same Chief Justice, if you talk about the State of Oregon's court and e-court, please.
Thank you. I'd like to call Judge Waller to the stand. I was thinking about re-entering private practice. I just got a little ahead of myself. I'd like to introduce Judge Nan Waller, the presiding judge of Multnomah County, and she'll be here to follow up my opening comments on the state of the courts and on e-court. Again, co-chairs, members of the committee, for this part of the record, my name is Paul DeMunis. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. And thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly about the state of our courts. I was very proud of our employees and judges during the last biennium. We managed to keep the courts open and accessible. And by that, our definition for open and accessible was we were able to process all the cases. Our courts were open 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, and the public had access to our counters throughout the state pretty much 5 days a week. We did that even though we had the same number of furlough days as the executive branch agencies who were closed on Fridays. We managed to keep the courts open in the last biennium. We're not able to do that this time. I'm sure many of you may have noticed in your own jurisdictions that we've had to order court closures for 9 days. Our first one occurred on the Friday after Thanksgiving. But more importantly to me is we've had to reduce the hours of the public's access. And by that, I mean when you go to the counter to get a document, to pay a fine, to do that kind of business with the court. And I think I'm having passed out here some impacts from various issues. One of the things about a decentralized institution like ours is that with the continuous budget reductions, it's hard to maintain a unified court system. And so what I mean by that is what they can do in one county, say a large county like Multnomah, Washington, or Clackamas, and what they can do in a smaller court system like Malheur or Josephine or Lake are different. And so we no longer have that same consistency about the public's access to our counters. I'd like to say that we have done basically everything we can do. We have explored and continue to implement every efficiency that that we can, and I'll just run through those very quickly. We now have an appellate e-court system. We have e-filing, electronic case management, electronic content management, which has greatly reduced our use of paper in that court. It grants great public access to the lawyers, very convenient. I know in my own family, my youngest son is a criminal defense lawyer, filed a mandamus with this court. I didn't get to rule on it, but he filed a mandamus with us at 11:50 p.m. On a Sunday night. That would have been impossible without electronic filing. And the convenience that that presents to the public. You may have read recently in the Oregonian, we're one of the, quote, agencies that cut our travel costs by nearly $400,000. We did that. We've centralized many of our accounting functions and our payment and receipt functions. I've centralized almost all of the prisoner litigation in this state. As you're aware, we now have 14 institutions, 14 prisons, and we have 14,000 inmates. I've now centralized that prison litigation to Salem. We do it all electronically. It saved all kinds of, millions of dollars in costs in travel, in paper, in postage. What I'm very proud of, I'll tell you something, this is pretty good for judges to be able to do this. Now with our centralized post-conviction and prisoner litigation, the lawyers post the evidence electronically on a secure website, and the judge who's assigned to that case can access that all that evidence through his or her computer, do all of that. So we've done everything we can, and we've done that ourselves. No additional resources given to us. We've done all of that ourselves. Many of you are aware that we've eliminated an entire division, the Court Programs and Services Division from OJD, which means we no longer have the kind of research and development capacity that an institution like ours should have so that we can innovate and continue to look forward. That also makes it very difficult for us to engage in our performance evaluation and outcome determinations that we need to do for evidence-based practices. Having said all that, we continue to do our best to provide an open and accessible court system to the public, but I do fear that we've reached the tipping point and that we will start to have the kinds of, I guess I should say, we'll have more of the kinds of impacts, negative impacts that I have distributed to you, the kinds of things where judgments don't get entered timely, real estate transactions get held up, children end up not with their parents or with the wrong parents, warrants don't get recalled or warrants don't get filed, people don't go to jail when they're supposed to or get out when they're supposed to, divorce decrees don't get filed, people don't get their Social Security, a variety of those things. Those are impacts that have already occurred, and my concern is as we move into the future that those will multiply. So I'm asking, I'll be asking the legislature in 2012 to, I'll try to bring some solutions to the table, but to work with the judicial branch to do our best to maintain an open and accessible court system. We sit at the intersection of every social, political, economic, and legal question that arises. No child enters or leaves foster care without a court order. We need to be able to handle all of our civil cases. We need to be able to enforce our private property and economic rights. And I believe a lot of that is at risk if justice is delayed. Thank you. Judge Waller.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County and one of the four e-court sponsors. I want to give you a little bit of information about where we are with e-court, and we've provided to you three pages of information on e-court. Oregon eCourt is a technology-based business transformation project of the courts, and we began in 2007. As the chief indicated, we completed eCourt in the appellate courts, and we are in June of this year in Yamhill County going to be ready to flip the switch, and they will be up on eCourt in June. Why eCourt? You've heard some of the reasons in terms of what has occurred in the courts as a result of the budget constraints. Beyond that, eCourt will allow us to assure the citizens in Oregon that they have better access to the courts, the judges have better information, that litigants have better information, and that we end up with better outcomes in the cases that come before the court. eCourt is a key strategy for us to be able to maintain access to the courts during these budget reductions and to really compensate for the staff reductions that we've already taken. We have a very committed workforce. They do beyond the pale in terms of trying to maintain the public service counters, get paper filed, into files, entered into OGIN, but we are really at the point where I don't think that much more can be asked of our staff. About a year ago, OJD moved to a single solution provider. We entered into a contract with Tyler Technology, and some of the information that I gave to you is about Tyler Technology. They are publicly traded. Operation. They have 2,500 employees focused solely on public sector software. They have had, and I think that this is the most important piece of information I can give you about Tyler, 100% successful implementation in the more than 350 jurisdictions that they have worked with. So we have no doubt that Oregon will be not break their record of 100% successful implementation. They have had six statewide implementations, some bigger than Oregon, some smaller than Oregon. They have done jurisdictions that are larger than Multnomah County. They have done very small jurisdictions. You'll see on the second page of what I gave you that we are right there in the middle in terms of the size of implementation and what we are doing. So we are satisfied that we won't present a challenge to Tyler in terms of their ability to get us up on eCourt. We had hoped, but we didn't have enough time to do a demonstration for you of Tyler. I know that a number of you in your hometowns have seen demonstrations. For those of you who have not had the opportunity, we would welcome the opportunity to show you how Tyler works. It's pretty impressive. It is an internet-based system. That means that we will have lawyers and other litigants able to access it 24/7. For lawyers, that probably is, some of them may not feel that's the best thing, to be able to do their work into the wee hours. But it's really important. I'm going to give you just a two-second snippet of why that's important. Domestic violence victims, it is often a difficult time to come to the courthouse and get a restraining order. It is a time when we know, based upon all of the research, that the risk goes up when people are making decisions about their own safety. In Multnomah County, we have the Gateway Domestic Violence Center. It is located far away from the courthouse. Right now, the city is having a courier every day deliver the restraining order applications that people fill out at the Gateway Center to the courthouse. We then do a video conference for the initial ex parte application, and then a courier picks up the restraining order orders and takes them back to Gateway. That's working for now, but how much more efficient for people to be able to not take that step towards the courthouse where they might feel that their safety is compromised, and do all of this electronically with the forms to be able to go straight from the Gateway Center, or that people can fill them out at home electronically rather than coming to the courthouse and waiting in line with their children until they are, it's the 1:30 hearing time. We will have e-filing and e-payment. Who doesn't pay their bills online and do much of their financial transactions online? Our customers expect the same. Case management. OGIN is a workhorse. It's very old, and it needs to be replaced, and we need greater functionality. Content management. We need to have better access to the information that comes before the court so that we can make decisions based upon full information. Financial management will replace FIOS. And the integration backbone, which I think is very exciting, is we will be able to get information out to our partners and in from our partners very, very quickly. So the kinds of things that the chief was talking about in terms of warrants getting to the jail on a timely basis, information getting out to the police, access to what's in an order that is being enforced on the spot by law enforcement is all very important. Where are we now? Our staff have been working very hard on configuration of Odyssey for Oregon. We are being very, very clear with everyone. We as sponsors passed guiding principles that we would do very minimal configuration so that we would be able to not have considerable configuration at greater cost and greater upkeep in terms of the maintenance. We start in Yamhill County as the first court that will be up and running in June of 2012, and that is to prove the product. Does it work in Oregon? We'll then expand to early adopter courts of different sizes in 2012-2013, which will prove the ability to bring this up to scale. Jackson, Lynn, Crook, Jefferson, and then Multnomah County. And Multnomah County will do in phases, civil, criminal, juvenile, et cetera. And then we do a rollout across the state. What are the benefits to eCourt? I think probably for all of you who operate every day using your computer, some of this is very self-evident. We will be a paper-on-demand court. Every year, we process about 50 million pieces of paper in our courts. Every single one of those pieces of paper is something that then needs to be handled by multiple people before it gets entered and usable and onto a court judge's bench. Multiple people will be able to access the file simultaneously, which is important in terms of the ability of a judge one and judge two, both making decisions about sometimes the same thing. And that recently happened in our court where an order didn't get entered on day one, and we ended up with two conflicting orders over the same child from different judges because the information simply wasn't accessible quickly and completely. E-filing and e-payment. Fewer trips to the courthouse, fewer lines. We have in our traffic line for initial appearances, it can be a two-hour wait for people. In Multnomah County, we have 3,650 phone calls into the courthouse every day. Many of those are for people to make payments. payments for restitution for their fines and fees. We drop off our phone calls at about a 20% rate for the high volume call lines. And that means delay in both payments and people being sometimes ending up not making the payments, which is not what we want. In Multnomah County, we get 8 feet of paper a day into the courthouse. We've run out of any place to store all of our files. And for those of you who've taken a tour of our courthouse and seen the basement, I'm sure you would agree that keeping that is not the best way to manage, but it's all that we have. We have over 1,600 people enter our downtown courthouse in Portland every day. We can greatly reduce the numbers of people who have to come to the courthouse and offer them far better service when they can access and the courthouse electronically. Every last year we sent out 141,000 jury summons. Ultimately, what we want is we want an electronic jury management system, which will greatly, again, help us with that enormous task of getting people to the courthouse to make decisions. There's a huge convenience factor for litigants, lawyers. We have, in Oregon, 85% of family law cases have one person who's not represented. One of the things that we hope to accomplish with eCourt is to have interactive forms that help people who are not represented. It takes a tremendous amount of time for court staff, for judges to deal with people who don't have lawyers, who have filled out their paperwork incorrectly, or they've simply filled out the wrong paperwork for what they're trying to accomplish. The level of frustration, the level of delay for them getting sometimes very important work done is tremendous. The interactive forms, think TurboTax, they'll help people through the process so that when they come to court, they have completely and properly filled out their paperwork. Far better information out to our community partners, to law enforcement, to the Department of Human Services, to the Department of Justice, to DOC. We will be able to both help them and help ourselves in terms of the transmittal of information that is incredibly important in terms of the well-being of people who have come before the court. We know that you have very, very difficult budget decisions to make this next month. I try every year to go to the Ways and Means, the traveling Ways and Means, and I think that every citizen should have to watch the traveling Ways and Means because you have hard decisions, and I think that people would have a much better understanding of what government does if they saw the vast amount of good that government does. And so we know that you have hard decisions, but we see eCourt as something that not only we need in order to be able to maintain in these reduced budget times, but also that the public needs in order to have the kind of access, which is what is contemplated in the Constitution for them to have to the courthouse in the 21st century. So we ask, we hope that we can demonstrate to those of you who haven't seen eCourt. We look forward, once we have flipped the switch in Yamhill, to being able to do field trips for those who are interested so that you can actually see it in action. And we look forward to being able to really do this enormous transformation of our courts. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Judge Waller or Chief Communis? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Stay seated there, Chief. Judge David Brewer, please, with the Court of Appeals. Next item on the agenda is discussion on the Court of Appeals workload and the need for additional judges.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I just want to briefly make the introductions. Chief Judge Brewer is here from the Court of Appeals, as is my good friend Judge Rick Hazelton from the Court of Appeals. And they're here to discuss with you the draft concept regarding an additional panel to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much, Chief, and co-chairs and members of the committee. Before I make some brief remarks to you about this LC that's before you today, I'd like to introduce my dear friend and colleague, Rick Hazelton. Judge Hazelton is the longest-serving judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals. He and I have been colleagues for the last 13 years. He is an outstanding jurist and an even better human being, and he will, this spring, become the new chief judge, subject to the Chief Justice's approval of the Oregon Supreme Court of Appeals. So I wanted you to meet him, and I'm absolutely confident that you'll enjoy your interactions with him and that he will have the same collegial partnership and relationship with his body that you've extended to me for the last 7 years, for which I'm very grateful.
You can all bind me to that appointment.
I never would purport to speak for the chief. This LC, as I think you all know, is a sequel to Senate Bill 388 passed out of both judiciary committees in this body in the 2011 legislative session with the full support that you gave us, and we very, very much appreciate it. In the end, there simply wasn't enough revenue to fund it. As I understand the LC and its current concept, it would have no fiscal impact if it were adopted in the 2012 special session for this biennium. It would have a delayed effect into the early portion of the next biennium, so that if it were not possible to fund it at that time, there would be a locus of return that the this body could decide not to pursue it. But it's our hope that perhaps by moving this LC and this bill this session, that we can get past the policy discussion and hopefully find enough revenue in the next session to fund this. Mm-hmm. Every judge and staff member of this Court of Appeals is very, very grateful to serve the people of Oregon, and it's a tremendous privilege for us to play a meaningful role in our public justice system. And we also have treasured the partnership with the legislature, including your passage of efficiency legislation for us in the 2009 session, which in many ways has helped the court through parts of the budget storm that we've experienced. And we're also very, very mindful of the challenges you face in balancing so many critical interests as you pave the way to Oregon's future in these upcoming sessions. But the simple facts are these. There have been no new judgeships in the Oregon Court of Appeals in 35 years. We have half the number of judges and staff of other intermediate appellate court courts around the country with similar caseloads. We are the first line court for almost all appeals in the Oregon state justice system, and we deal with some of the most complex arrays of cases that face courts in this state. We need the best and most productive minds who are committed to public service to do this work, and this work is done willingly, gladly, and with full support at a sacrifice to the personal lives of the judges on the court, many of whom work anywhere from 60 to 80 hours a week just to keep up. And that presence of pressure, of course, is felt by the staff as well. And we are very challenged to keep up with our work. I'll share with you a couple of statistics in just a minute. But if additional cuts, including layoffs, were to occur after the February session, we would go even farther in reverse. To give you a sense a little bit of the workload and the difficulty of keeping up with it in the Court of Appeals, we have taken some real pride in the number of authored opinions that the Court has produced over the years. This last year was no exception. Despite a substantial turnover in judges, we produced more than 470 authored opinions covering every range of subject matter under Oregon law. And despite that, and what for me is a pretty telling stat, if you compare where the court is in terms of its caseload of cases taken under advisement but not yet decided over the last several years, it's pretty stunning. At the end of 2009, we had a total of 285 cases under advisement. Only five had been under advisement for more than a year. That's five too many. And at the end of 2010, the court's number of cases under advisement had gone up to 330, and we had 11 cases that had been under advisement for more than a year. And at the end of this last year, despite an almost record number of opinions, the court had 366 cases under advisement at the end of the year, including two that had been under advisement for more than 2 years. And that's unconscionable, in my view. But it's not because people aren't working their tails off. They really are. The issue is really, for me, and I think for the court, in talking to you about this, as difficult as it is in these tough budget times, a real strong sense that we all have of the economic impact value of having a rule of law, both in terms of processing important civil cases, land use cases, having timely criminal justice for victims and for others involved in that system. It's a factor that businesses, that individuals take into account when they decide where to live and where to locate. And so in many ways, your Court of Appeals, the workhorse court in the Oregon judicial system, is the canary in the coal mine in terms of looking at the overall economic well-being of our citizens who need to have their cases resolved with reliable finality in real time. And that challenge is growing. We're not here to whine. We're not here to complain. We do the work and we get paid for it. But the truth is, you need to know these things so we can have real conversations about the kind of system we need in order to lead the way towards the economic recovery and to have the social and economic well-being in this state that we all want to have. And so we appreciate very much your bringing this this concept back to the surface in this legislative session with everything else that's going on. But we also agree with you in having done that, that it's a very important thing to make an investment in for the future of Oregon. Chief?
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Representative Krieger, Pro-Chair Krieger.
I want to make a little statement first. I happened to get on an airplane with Judge Brewer October 15th, 2009 in Eugene, and we went to Austin, Texas. And he has a stack of briefs in his seat this high that he worked on for that entire 4.5 hour flight. So these guys are putting out a lot of effort and work, and no one's putting out the effort in any court that I'm aware of that's as great as this effort has been. Could one of you maybe talk to us a little bit about how our land use system might cause a load a little bit different than what you might see coming in from other states that don't have our land use system?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, most of those cases go to the Court of Appeals, and so I'll ask Chief Judge Brewer to do that. We get very few of them in the Supreme Court.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the question. Representative Krieger, the Court of Appeals receives 30 to 50 and sometimes even more land use appeals every year. Those are reviews of adjudications from the Land Use Board of Appeals. There are also reviews of quasi-legislative policy-type decisions from LCDC, and they're almost equally split. They are some of the most dense and difficult work in our system. They're also work that the court has to do under deadlines of 91 days from submission. So when we did a weighted caseload study that was presented to this body in 2011, we presented information that showed that that's about roughly 2% of our caseload, but by density, by weight, in terms of the amount of effort it takes because of the complexity of the record and the legal issues, it's about 8% of the caseload. So those are huge economic drivers, Representative Krieger, and you're seeing that work done under very, very tight deadlines. It also creates the opportunity cost of not being able to get to other work that is also very important while we're focusing on that. We have two very important bills that were passed in the 2011 legislative session related to land use economic development, the Urban Reserve Bill. And it was one of the most difficult things that somebody with a business background had to do to have conversations with members of this body when an effort was made, and it was a good effort. It was a well-intentioned effort. It was the right thing to do to add additional work to the Court of Appeals workload in this area and require it to be done in 91 days. And the answer we gave, the chief and I gave, was we want to do this work. We should be doing this work. It's absolutely critical, but we need your help in deciding what we can't do if we're going to do it in 91 days. And those are the kinds of difficult conversations we hate to have with you about this. I don't, my worst nightmare is, frankly, I'll just share this with you, is for us to affirm without an opinion a case, because we do it as a case management tool to move the cases ahead, and to miss something. And especially to have the Supreme Court to have to waste its time to accept review and maybe even reverse that case because the court didn't have enough resources to get at it and do it right the first time. There's nothing that should worry us all more than that. Now, thankfully, that's a very, very rare event. But if you want to know what keeps me awake at night, Representative Krueger, that's it.
Representative Watton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. What are the numbers on affirmed without opinions over the last 4 or 5 years? Is there a trend, and do we see more AWOPs because of the disproportionate workload?
Co-chairs and Representative Juan, that's an absolutely great question. Truth is that the court's AWOP rate is an astounding 70%, but it's been that way for the last 20 years. The court has systematically adapted to the dysfunction of inadequate funding by not being transparent. But it's simply a matter of how are you going to triage the work and write published and authored opinions on the most serious, the most difficult problems, and then affirm without opinion the vast majority of cases that may be affirms but would benefit from a written opinion for the sake of everybody. It's just a matter of triage, Representative Wand.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, and you touched on it a little bit, but can you just elaborate just a little bit on the value to the legal community, the business community, and to the public in affirming a trial court decision but in writing an opinion?
Absolutely. Co-chairs and Representative Wand, another excellent question. What we do, even as an error-correcting court, Court of Appeals corrects errors. It doesn't announce law, unlike the Supreme Court. But what we do is give guidance to the trial bar and the trial bench. A lot of the issues that we think are relatively easy are regularly recurring issues in the trial court. And if that case is AWOPed, affirmed without opinion, then the people who deal with that in the trenches every day at least haven't had the benefit of an answer by an appellate court. And that proliferates the risk of mistakes that need to be fixed later. It's not a healthy situation, Representative Wong.
Thank you.
President Courtney, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Your Honor, Judge Brewer, I'm somewhat familiar with the Court of Appeals. Now, the original court in 69 was 5 judges, and they all met together. You're now 10. Now, there's a visual here I want you to help me with. You want 13 judges on the Court of Appeals. Are you planning, or whoever is planning, to meet them, have them full court at all at any given time, or all 13 judges are hearing a case? Is that going to happen?
Co-chairs and Senator Courtney, who knows the Court of Appeals as well or better than anybody around, another great question. The answer, sir, is yes.
All 13 judges are going to hear it.
No, not.
Well, I just said that. They're sitting in panel. All 13 are there.
Not on a panel, President Courtney. They would be in full court, in bank. But we would still be doing 3 judge panels. It would just.
Well, all right. The point is, you would have the chief judge sitting there, flanked by the full court in the famous building over there hearing this.
No, sir.
That's never going to happen.
No, sir. It would be 3 judge panels. We would be adding just a panel to the court.
So every decision comes out of a 3-judge panel, no more than that.
We do take cases in bank, Senator Courtney, and so we take a small percentage of cases in full court, but they're not reheard at that time. What happens is they are referred to full court from a panel decision, and then the entire court ends up voting on the case. That's a very small percentage of our work. That process, as we envision it, President Courtney, would not change with the addition of one more
panel. So if one of the panels kicks it up, all 13 are going to vote?
If Senator Courtney, if the case is referred to full court, then all the judges would vote whether to take it in bank. I worry that I'm not...
At any time will a decision come down in writing, concurred in or dissented a whole bit by all 13?
Rarely, but it could happen.
Could happen.
Yes.
That is amazing. I would not want to be the chief judge of that court. Have you thought about that? That's a significant number of judges at one time sitting together. Are you aware of that?
Senator Courtney, yes, sir, I am. In fact, you might be interested to know that the New Jersey Court of Appeals, which
I don't think New Jersey is any model for me. I mean, that's fine with me. But
they've got 26, and they have a full court model. But to be honest with you, I think if we went much beyond 13, you'd have a critical mass, that the decision-making would be a bigger problem. Frankly, Senator Courtney, our workload study showed that we need substantially more judges than one more panel. But the court isn't asking for that, and frankly, one of the reasons is just that. I think it's very difficult for a collegial body to make decisions when it gets that big in a court setting.
Thank you. Just one more, can I please?
Please. You bet.
you have appointed either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Muniz, an official or a board person or an individual, I forget the title, who hears just motions? What is that? I guess that got by me. What is that all about, please? Speaking of resources, you want the ECO in terms of helping you with your case.
Co-chairs, President Courtney, we have a commissioner that hears motions for the Court of Appeals. Chief Judge Brewer can tell you, I think it's been, we had 2 years?
It's about 3 years.
3 years.
It's a full paid position. They have a law clerk, the whole bit, right? They hear just motions. Okay. How did that happen? Did we give you that authority? Who made that? Where did that come from?
We do have a statute, don't we?
Yes. Co-chairs and Senator Courtney, yes, this body authorized that in the 2009 legislative session. And it is an appellate commissioner who was already a full-time employee of the Court of Appeals, but was given the authority to decide motions.
Are you gonna, do you have any more of those type of positions you got in mind to deal with this versus full judges?
At this time, we think we've sort of hit the limit on what we can resolve without adding judges to it because of the concern of having quality judicial review.
Thank you, Chair.
Question,
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, do we have an average number of days that a civil appellate decision is held under advisement? And the reason why I ask the question is because I'm aware that when a money judgment is entered, interest begins to accrue even during the appellate process. And so I'm wondering about that length of time.
Co-chairs and Representative Wand, we have an average length of time on the civil cases that are taken under advisement of approximately 120 days. Those are the ones taken under advisement, but some are even longer than that.
You need to add the period of time it takes to get an argument.
Right. The Chief has pointed out to me something that was implicit in your question, but it takes 5 to 8 months after that case is at issue to even get it set for oral argument. So if you want to talk about interest, you've got to add that into it as well.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Brewer, can you talk about the movement toward two judge panels? How many cases now were being heard in the two judge authority that we gave you maybe in 2009?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, in 2009 you gave us the authority to sit in two judge panels. What I have done is set at least every other month in a two judge panel with a senior judge, and we take about 40 cases at a time and decide those in that setting. They're generally criminal cases and post-conviction cases, and that allows us to move a large number of cases and free up docket space on the three judge panels for the court's other work. So that's typically how we've done it. Also, our motions department, which does review the motions commissioner's rulings when they're challenged, is a two judge panel as well.
On a two judge panel, what happens if the two disagree?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, by statute, we add a third. The case isn't reheard in oral argument, but we add a third. That judge reviews the record and the oral argument record and then participates in the decision.
No questions? Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break to get some people on the phone.